Hello and welcome to the EMG Health Podcast. This is your host, Dr. Jonathan Sakia, and I'm delighted to be joined today by a guest all the way from the beautiful beach town of Durban in South Africa, Professor Sabiha Essack. Kind of wish I was there right now instead of autumnal and rainy London, although I'm told it's a little bit chilly there today. Sabiha Essack is a pharmacist by training and holds a research chair in antibiotic resistance and One Health at the University of KwaZulu-Natal in Durban. She's the senior implementation research advisor to the International Center for Antimicrobial Resistance Solutions in Denmark and serves as an expert consultant on antimicrobial resistance and antimicrobial stewardship to the World Health Organization. So today we're going to discuss the topic of antimicrobial resistance, looking more specifically at its links with COVID-19 and what we can learn from the current pandemic to help mitigate the risk of AMR in the future. Having learned about her in advance of this conversation, I am, simply put, in awe. Welcome to the podcast, Sabiha.
Thank you, Jonathan, for your kind words and your welcome. It is a pleasure and an honor to be here.
So, as with any crisis, Sabiha, COVID-19 has spotlighted and exacerbated areas in healthcare where perhaps we have been falling behind. What areas for improvement do you think that the pandemic has spotlighted the most?
I want to answer this question at two levels, Jonathan. First, the country level, and second, the healthcare level in particular. In terms of the country level, in a nutshell, COVID-19 highlighted the lack of preparedness of health systems to deal with a public health emergency of global proportions. This lack of preparedness was equally evident in high as well as low-income countries. I want to put the country response into the context of the international health regulations, the purpose of which, and I'm citing directly from the document, is to prevent, protect against, control, and provide a public health response to the international spread of disease in ways that are commensurate with and restricted to public health risks and which avoid unnecessary interference with international traffic and trade. You will agree that this did not happen during the COVID-19 pandemic. The international health regulations require countries to participate in something called the Joint External Evaluation. That evaluates a country's capacity to prevent, detect, and rapidly respond to public health threats, independently of whether they are naturally occurring, like COVID-19, deliberate or accidental. Even the countries that scored well on the JEEs, as they are called, actually responded poorly to the pandemic, highlighting the fact that paper-based evaluations are not a true reflection of actual preparedness and capability when it's actually go time. In terms of healthcare, the pandemic highlighted deficiencies in basic infection prevention and control protocols. Hospitals lacked isolation wards, dedicated ICUs, personal protective equipment, and disinfection protocols for hospital environments. The deficiencies were obviously more pronounced in low and middle income countries. For example, my country developed an infection prevention and control policy during the throes of the pandemic, a policy that was on the table for some time as part of our AMR strategy. Health systems resources were diverted to the pandemic response, compromising a number of outpatient or community level services such as vaccination programs, prenatal and antenatal care, and the management of chronic as communicable as well as non-communicable diseases, while in-hospital services such as antimicrobial stewardship and antimicrobial resistance surveillance were deprioritized. In fact, shut down in certain instances.
Well, shut down in England, frankly. I mean, so much chronic care and cancer care has just been deferred to another day.
Absolutely.
But anyway, I'm sorry for interrupting you. Please carry on.
Elective surgeries as well. So basically, the pandemic highlighted our lack of preparedness at both country and health systems levels. But in defense, Jonathan, we are dealing with an unknown pathogen. We are learning every day about its transmission dynamics, its viability in air and on different surfaces, its pre-symptomatic and asymptomatic infectivity potential, and the long and short-term sequelae. It's like building the train tracks while the train is moving at full speed.
I think it's also fair to say, you talked at the beginning of your response that that, that there should be collaboration between nations. We should all be talking as you know, one people, one species. And that sure as heck hasn't happened. So moving on to a different perspective, the symptoms may present like a common cold or the flu, although, of course, we're learning more, as you've said. And, you know, someone could have COVID-19, but it could be another viral infection. Are we seeing, or are we at risk of seeing, especially in the winter seasons, an increase in antibiotic prescriptions that are completely unnecessary? In fact, I was in a taxi yesterday, and the driver was telling me he had COVID, and his doctor had prescribed antibiotics, and I'm completely dumbfounded.
So let's answer your question first, Jonathan. It's yes and no, and I'll explain a little bit more. But maybe let me start up by saying that there are currently no antimicrobial medicines available for the treatment of COVID-19. And I'll expand on that a little more. So if I'm answering yes to unnecessary antibiotic prescriptions, I want to start by saying that COVID is indeed a viral respiratory tract infection. And its clinical manifestations range from mild influenza-like illness to severe pneumonia. Although these statistics are changing all the time, approximately 14% of COVID-19 patients develop severe disease that requires hospitalization and oxygen support. About 5% require admission to an intensive care unit, while the vast majority of patients will develop non-severe illness and can be managed at an outpatient basis. And the non-severe cases are managed by self-isolation, good hygiene practices, and symptomatic treatment. To reiterate, there are no antimicrobial medicines available for the treatment of COVID-19. And although there's very little literature on the management of non-severe COVID-19, inappropriate antibiotic use in self-limiting viral upper respiratory tract infections, such as the flu and the cold, is very well documented. For example, outpatient settings account for the majority of antibiotic prescriptions in the US, one-third, 33% of which are unnecessary. Another example in the Netherlands, 46% of antibiotic prescriptions for upper respiratory tract infections did not comply with guidelines. And in your country, the UK, there's 10% of the highest prescribing general practices prescribe antibiotics for 72% of colds, 90% of patients with otitis media, 78% of people with sore throats, and 100% of cases of rhinosinusitis, the runny nose. And we know that the vast majority of these would have been by viruses. So the use in COVID.
That's astonishing. We're facing a crisis as far as antimicrobials are concerned. And 100% of cases of basically runny noses get antibiotics. Yeah. That is absurd.
It is indeed worrying. And an antibiotic use at community level may be higher in countries where antibiotics can be procured over the counter without a prescription, and in some low and middle income countries from informal drug sellers. So based on the literature and previous experience and my experience in African countries, there may well be an increase in unnecessary antibiotic prescriptions during the flu season in the winter months, as we have seen over the years. So I answered this question.
So it's basically a setup for your comment about building the train tracks as the train is coming down the line. Here, this is a setup for the perfect storm, isn't
Absolutely.
It?
Absolutely. It's a silent tsunami, as people have quite frequently described it. So I answered yes or no to this question. So this is the no part of it. So on the other hand, we have seen a change in health-seeking behavior of people during the COVID-19 pandemic, with many opting not to visit healthcare facilities for risk of contact with COVID-19 patients. So less patient encounters may then decrease antibiotic prescription and reduce unnecessary prescription. So what I would like to propose is we should conduct an antibiotic prescription audit and correlate these with patient encounters during the winter months of 2019 compared to 2020 to determine which of these scenarios actually plays out. So will COVID-19 result in greater antibiotic prescriptions or lesser? And just really, this depends on the country context, health-seeking behavior, prescribing practice, diagnostics, etc.
Well, it's a great suggestion, and given that our audience are largely healthcare practitioners, maybe we can encourage their participation. I think it's a great idea. So let's get specific to COVID-19. What's the link between AMR and COVID-19? You've hinted at it in your last response, but anyway, can you expand?
So Jonathan, I've got lots of yes and no questions. So COVID-19 management practices may either worsen or alleviate AMR. So let me explain. So COVID-19 has the potential to exacerbate AMR by increasing the selection pressure of extensive and inappropriate antimicrobial use. And we're seeing this already mainly in the hospital settings. Despite lack of evidence to support their use, antiretrovirals, antimalarials, and antibiotics are currently being used globally in the management of COVID-19. Incorrectly, but used nonetheless. Several reviews have shown disproportionate antimicrobial use compared with bacterial and fungal co-infections or secondary infections. So the infections are just not there to merit antibiotic use. We know that antimicrobial resistance is a function of time in use. The greater the quantities of antimicrobials used and the longer the period for which they've been used, the greater the selection pressure for the development and escalation of AMR. So inappropriate antimicrobial use in COVID-19 patients can result in worsening AMR. So now let's put the opposite perspective forward. COVID-19 has also presented an opportunity to mitigate AMR by preventing infection. The use of masks, social distancing measures, and hand hygiene are measures to prevent the transmission of infection. Quite simply put, if one does not get an infection, one does not require antimicrobial therapy, thereby decreasing the selection pressure and potentially alleviating AMR. Just to speak about a little bit about preventing infection, besides the social behavioral aspects of masks and distancing and hand washing, infections can also be prevented by vaccination, good water hygiene and sanitation infrastructure, good personal hygiene, and targeted hygiene in home and everyday settings, while infection prevention and control measures are required in healthcare facilities.
So this is actually a topic that we've discussed from different perspectives recently in a conversation with Professor Sally Bloomfield talking about home hygiene. I guess with better communication nowadays, stories travel around the globe. And of course, there's also media sensationalism. And then there's people with perverse needs to disseminate conspiracy theories. And I'm not even going to get into political machinations. But we do need to engage stakeholders and basically get them on board, educate them, engage with them to make a real impact, particularly those who are decision makers. And I rail against this. By the way, I hate the word unprecedented relating to the pandemic. It's been precedented.
An ideal opportunity.
How can the lessons that we've learned from COVID-19 address AMR
on the global and national public health agendas? The current AMR is currently on the back burner, but this has to be forefronted again and can be done, in my opinion, in four key ways. Firstly, we present AMR as the silent pandemic that is adversely affecting humans, animals, crops, the environment, and the various interfaces and ecologies. But AMR is a One Health issue, and its impact is so much more far-reaching than COVID-19. Second, we highlight the collateral damage of COVID-19 in escalating AMR because of excessive and inappropriate antimicrobial use, and I spoke to that in my earlier response. Policymakers should be made aware of the fact that every single AMR indicator will be worsened, and several sustainable development goals that are directly or indirectly associated with AMR will be compromised, as will be progress on the international health regulations. Thirdly, we advocate for infection prevention strategies such as vaccination, wash, which is water sanitation and hygiene, and infection prevention and control. Policymakers should be equally aware of the interventions that will prevent and contain AMR and facilitate progress towards the SDGs. And finally, we emphasize that AMR requires the very same whole of society, whole of government, top-down and bottom-up mobilization from policymakers to civil society as it is currently in place for COVID-19. Jonathan, the caution I would introduce here is to ensure consistent, accurate messaging at all levels, as you alluded to earlier, taking due cognizance of differences in health literacy, especially in low and middle income countries, to ensure the whole of society ownership in mitigating AMR.
Yeah, you know, it all looks good on paper, and you talk about the Sustainable Development Goals of the United Nations. Your presentation of the data is compelling to a health professional audience. Although I have to tell you, one of my ex-residents is convinced, he's one of these conspiracy theory guys. There are people out there who think it's 5G. There are people who think there is no pandemic. This is all part of the manipulation of some kind of government cabal. I worry for the future of humanity. But anyway, let's take my paranoia out the equation. How much of a focus are we seeing here when it comes to community-based infection control programs?
So let me answer that in the context of the Global Action Plan on Antimicrobial Resistance. It has 5 strategic objectives, and the third one is to improve hygiene, sanitation, and infection prevention and control in an effort to prevent infection and therefore preclude the need for antibiotics. Now, most of the national action plans have focused on IPC, as it's commonly abbreviated, in healthcare, and some mentioned...
Can you state again, that's the infection prevention and control,
absolutely,
right?
Absolutely, infection prevention and control.
Okay.
So most of the national action plans have focused on infection prevention and control in healthcare, and some mentioned vaccination programs at a community level, but very few, if any, have actually mentioned community-based infection control programs or hygiene and sanitation within home or everyday life settings like schools and workplaces. And with COVID-19, the focus on schools, workplaces, factories, railway stations, bus stations, etc., has become spotlighted. It is important that all stakeholders recognize the role of hygiene in the home and the community as an effective part of the solution to help reduce AMR. The behavioral interventions could potentially reduce all communicable diseases if they are correctly and consistently implemented.
Okay, so this I referenced earlier, we've done a few podcasts about antimicrobial resistance, and I'm part of an initiative with the Global Chief Medical Officers Network to address this. And in fact, we just published a paper that looked at what companies were doing on, if you will, a community level, because companies are, you know, society in microcosm. And again, this is something that I think as physicians we have a major obligation to disseminate. And the Global Hygiene Council's working in this area. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Sure. So the Global Hygiene Council is a group of global AMR, infection prevention and control, and public health experts who have been leading and promoting the benefits of community hygiene to prevent infections and also help reduce AMR. We convened a meeting of global hygiene experts in London last year to review the role of hygiene as part of the solution to mitigate AMR, and have subsequently developed a position paper that was recently published in the American Journal of Infection Control. We also developed a manifesto that aims to ensure that hygiene in the home and community is recognized as an important strategy to address AMR, and that it is somehow included in the global antimicrobial resistance action plans when it comes up for review, as well as national action plans on AMR by at least 2025. The Global Hygiene Council has initiated considerable stakeholder engagement and is hopefully on track to achieve meaningful change by advocacy in this area.
So a few minutes ago, I mentioned that I'd talked to Professor Sally Bloomfield about the role of hygiene in mitigating infections. And she talks about the journey of the germ. So for anyone listening, check out that podcast. It gels perfectly with what Sabiha is saying. So home and community hygiene can help to reduce COVID infection transmission, right?
So, Jonathan, congratulations on that podcast with Sally. It was indeed very interesting and enlightening, and it really gels very well with this podcast today. So to answer your question, hygiene is one of the most effective ways of preventing the spread of community-based infections such as colds, influenza, gastrointestinal, and skin infections. Being an academic, I always rely on statistics. So let me give you a few statistics on the benefits of improved hygiene in a non-healthcare setting. Improved hygiene can reduce antibiotic prescriptions by 25%, by a quarter. Improved hygiene reduces the risk of common infections such as diarrhea by half, 50%. Practicing good hygiene in a community setting can reduce antibiotic use for respiratory tract infections in particular by 30%. We can do better, I think, Jonathan. These infections would be typically viral and not impacted by the use of antibiotics. And just again, some US statistics, implementing improved hygiene strategies in the home have been shown to save $138 million in direct medical costs. So hygiene practices such as hand washing that have now become an essential part of everyone's daily routine and is the first line of defense will reduce the transmission of infection. It is just important that we sustain this momentum and make it a habit.
Yeah, I think that looking around, certainly London and seeing all the changes and thinking, well, that's probably going to remain as it is for the remainder of my life. And I think some of these habits will be sustainable, but we still have the problem. I mean, we've had over 7,000 cases a day now. We're going way back up in the UK. And some of it, I strongly believe, is because of intransigence or ignorance of the facts by people. And again, I think we as physicians have to do a better job educating patients on the importance of this. Many people are working and communicating remotely, if at all. How do we do that? What do we do?
So the increase in digital consultations has been linked to increased antibiotic prescriptions. So to help prescribers, I want to refer them to the infographics from the World Health Organization and the Global Hygiene Council that can be used to digitally communicate the social behavioral interventions, symptomatic relief, and just general information on how non-severe COVID can be managed symptomatically and does not require anything other than symptomatic treatment.
Well, in fact, I mean, many interactions between physicians and virtual interactions between physicians and patients need not be for COVID. It could be just as, you know, you hinted at earlier, sore throats, runny noses, otitis, and, you know, a concerned GP who's worried about patients, worried about doing the wrong thing, may say, oh, what the heck, and prescribe antibiotics anyways. So we've all adopted new practices, new habits. Whether it's remembering to grab our masks along with our keys and wallets or washing our hands. What key changes or everyday habits do you believe need to take place on an individual level and a wider community level to reduce infection and therefore AMR?
So all of the current behavioral interventions such as wearing masks, socially distancing, consciously washing our hands, and practicing targeted hygiene in everyday settings will decrease the incidence of all communicable diseases, not just COVID-19. We would see a reduction in the cases of respiratory and gastrointestinal infections, both of which are amongst the leading cause of death, especially in low and middle income countries. The reduction in infections, as discussed earlier, would come with a reduction in antimicrobial use and a subsequent reduction in AMR. The challenge is to ensure that these measures are implemented correctly. How often have we seen a mask below the nose? And consistently, such that there's a sustainable behavior change. And the prerequisite for sustainable change is health literacy. So people are more likely to habitually wear masks, wash their hands, keep a distance from each other, if they clearly understand that the measures are being implemented for the good of public health and will protect them, their loved ones, and broader community. If you want to bring in a model, I would suggest the COMB model that stipulates three preconditions for behavior change: capability, which is knowledge and skills, opportunity, which is physical and social, and motivation. Now, capability and motivation relate to health literacy, while opportunity is affected by socioeconomic circumstances. For example, it would be impossible to practice social distancing in the slums of India or the informal settlements of South Africa. Hand washing would serve absolutely no purpose if a single surface water source is used for domestic purposes, for cooking and cleaning, for recreation, as well as a latrine. So inculcating such habits should consider country contexts.
Yes, absolutely. And also, I think, just for the sake of humanity, we have to take the politics out of this. I was recently on the underground and looked around the carriage, and there were 20 people in the carriage, 19 of whom were appropriately wearing a mask. And there was one young guy sitting there, and his body language screamed, bring it on. And he was not wearing a mask. And it's the rule that you have to wear masks. So I did it. I went up and talked to him about it. And his, you know, I think he thought I was looking for a fight. And I said, no, I just want to let you know, you know, if you have a mum or a dad, it could be your mum or dad that catches coronavirus because you're not wearing a mask. That changed the narrative in his head. We've got to do a better job changing the narrative.
Absolutely.
So let's look at your part of the world. Are people in your community being responsive to the measures we need to impose to control this wretched pandemic?
So compliance with the measures was dictated by the level of health literacy, and I take your point about communicating in a way that the person in the train understood you. So it was dictated by the level of health literacy, socioeconomic status, as well as cultural and religious norms. So as mentioned earlier, social distancing was not possible in informal settlements with high population densities, and hand washing was superfluous in the absence of access to clean water. Religious practices resulted in large numbers of people in indoor spaces, and cultural norms necessitated physical contact. So compliance with the measures required engagement, consultation, and communication at community level that explained what was being done, why it was being done, how it was being done, and what were the consequences should it not be done. We didn't get this quite right in South Africa on a communication level, although it was all of the interventions were well justified and with the best of intentions. We fell down a little in communicating the reasons behind it, and so mobilizing the broader community to comply with these interventions.
Yeah. Looking around the world, I know there are some countries that did, quote, get it right. And, you know, I've mentioned New Zealand under Jacinda Ardern's leadership. But then again, I've had the privilege of going to New Zealand. It's a series of islands thousands of miles from anywhere. So it's very easy for them to close their borders. And it's, you know, a comparatively small population in comparatively few centers. So I think we do have to disseminate information better country to country, as you said right at the beginning of this. So we know that the current pandemic is due to a virus that has jumped species, just as many have before. And your continent, the African continent, has seen massive changes to its environment due to progress. That's in inverted commas, and the imposition of humanity on the natural beauty with some unexpected and dire consequences, bats being driven out of their natural environment, humans coming into contact with animals that they normally would not. Are we going to learn the very worrying lessons this virus has taught us, or are we going to one day have to deal with a virus as contagious as COVID-19, and an organism with the fatality rates of Ebola? It's not, maybe not, are we going to? When is probably the better question.
Exactly, Jonathan. It's not if, it's when. The COVID-19 pandemic exposed, as I said earlier, our lack of preparedness. to respond to public health crises in spite of paper-based progress on international health regulations and the global health security agenda. We have not taken adequate lessons from Ebola and Zika and SARS and MERS, perhaps because they were localized in the developing world. The health, economic, and societal impact of COVID can only be described as, I won't say unprecedented, but catastrophic. The valuable lessons we learned should be used to strengthen research, collaboration, and One Health systems and programs at global, regional, and national levels. Yesterday, there was a side event at the World Health Assembly that aimed to break the panic, then forget cycle. And it is so important for us to remember what brought us here. The new normal should never forget the devastation of what got us here with the COVID-19 pandemic.
Yeah, I know that, and I'm not going to mention individual politicians or political parties, but ascribing blame to one country, I remember having a conversation with a virologist friend of mine who was explaining to me the way that viruses jump species, if you will. And he said, until the world has an equality so that people do not have to live in close proximity to domestic animals, we will see these viral transitions. And so what's the old expression? Someone sneezes in Shanghai and someone catches a cold in Edinburgh. So yeah, we truly are a global community. So let's take this to sort of a gazing into a crystal ball, if you will. If you awoke tomorrow morning and learned that you are now the chief medical officer of the entire world, by the way, I love asking my guests this, what three things would you do to improve human health?
I would first and foremost institute a One Health approach, as the health of humans, animals, and the environment is inextricably linked. You mentioned, Jonathan, that until we change the circumstance where environments are not shared between humans and animals, we are always going to be at risk of infection by zoonotic pathogens. So the vast majority of epidemics in the recent past have been by zoonosis, transmission from animals to humans. The environmental aspects of these diseases have not been adequately investigated, but I'm convinced that environmental reservoirs and sources exist as humans and animals come together at environmental interfaces. So my first and foremost one initiative would be to institute a One Health approach. I would secondly institute universal health coverage, such that every person has equitable access to quality health care that does not impose financial hardship, because health is an inalienable human right. And I would thirdly focus on improving the health literacy of all people, from policymakers to civil society, in an effort to promote health and wellness and prevent diseases, to realize the WHO definition that health is a state of complete physical, mental, and social well-being, and not merely the absence of disease or infirmity.
I think with that answer, I'm going to start a political campaign to have you appointed chief medical officer of the entire world. That was eloquently stated. Sabiha, it's been very enlightening to have this unique and specialized perspective on what is a critically important subject. As I said, we've done a number of podcasts on this and we'll continue until this isn't an issue anymore. I want to thank you, Professor Sabiha Essak, for coming on to the podcast today to share your opinions and insight with our listeners. It's been an absolute pleasure. And I hope that our listeners apply what they've heard today in their everyday practices, because we've all got to do our bit. Sabiha, thank you.
It's my pleasure, Jonathan.
And as I said before, I think we're going to have you back to discuss progress in the future. Well, folks, that's it for today. Please don't forget to share this episode, subscribe, and tune in again next Friday to hear from me and another fascinating guest. Take care, stay well, and bye for now.